Well, we're up to the third slide in this organic chemistry chapter. And so we've been talking about the specialness of carbon, which of course is at the heart of organic compounds. In this slide, we are looking at carbon, but alongside the three other biggies in terms of atoms when it comes to making up organisms. So this is what all organisms are made up of, a lot of. And what's depicted here in various ways is the valence of these. What do these four atoms have in common? Yes, they're all non-metals. And therefore, they are eligible for making covalent bonds, right? What is the valence? No.
The number of electrons needed to fill that outer shell?
Exactly. How many more electrons you would have to add to that outer shell to fill it? Now, what you described, the number that's in that outer shell, is the number of valence electrons. That's another use of the same word.
But I said missing.
Oh, did you? Oh, I misheard you. Sorry. That's right. It's missing in a sense. Yeah, there's that many more electrons that can be added. And these nonmetals can therefore form what kind of bonds? Well, that was kind of a trick question. A nonmetal can form a covalent bond or an ionic bond, depending on what it's bonding with, right? But what happens, I mean, what do nonmetals form covalent bonds with? Nonmetals, right. And they can be the same nonmetal, just another atom of it, or they can be other, different nonmetals. But just keep in mind that an ionic bond involves a nonmetal as well, right? A metal and a nonmetal in that case. That's not a sharing of electrons, that's a transfer of electrons. So, practically speaking, if you are building a molecule out of nonmetal atoms, what does the valence tell you? Well, not really, because when you share a pair, one of those electrons comes from the nonmetal that's bonding with something else. Each pair of electrons really gets that atom, if it is covalently bonded to something, it gets a credit for just one more electron, right? Because one of those two shared electrons it already had as its own property. But what I mean by practically speaking, what does the valence tell you? We've defined it, yes, that it is the number of additional electrons that need to be added to give it its outer shell stability like the noble gases. But practically what the valence should tell you is how many covalent bonds that kind of atom has to make if it's going to be part of a molecule. And remember that a molecule is a specific word. It refers to a covalent structure, right? A salt is not a molecule. It's an ionic compound. Well, covalent structures don't even have to be compounds, because you can get two of the same nonmetal together. But if you get two or more different nonmetals together covalently, it's a molecule still, but in that case it's a compound. What I'm saying, though, is that hydrogen has a valence of one, and we've already talked about why that's true, right? But what that means practically is that any molecule that hydrogen is going to be a molecule, a member of in a molecule, is going to be forming exactly one covalent bond. Oxygen has a valence of two, so every oxygen in every molecule is forming two total bonds. Nitrogen's forming three because of its valence. Well, carbon is a special compared to these three because it has a valence of four, which in one word you can say is that carbon is tetravalent, or that's an adjective. You could also say it has tetravalence. tetra simply means four. Right? And because of the eight being such a special number, you know, in that second period, four is basically halfway filled. And carbon is a nonmetal, so it can form covalent bonds with nonmetals. But because it has a valence of four, it has to make four bonds to be satisfied, and will in any molecule it's part of. But that gives it a lot more versatility compared to these other nonmetals that have lower valences. And that's because there's a lot of different ways carbon can bond to other things. It has to make four bonds. Well, one possibility is that it makes four single covalent bonds. Or it could make two double bonds that add up to four. Or it can make a triple bond and a single bond. That in itself is a variety, right? But then if you consider how many ways it can make four single bonds, it can make them with four of the same thing, four of the same thing but a different thing, and so on. Or it can make it with two of one atom and two of another atom, four different atoms. There's all kinds of possibilities. And that tetravalence is why carbon is involved in so many molecules. Now, we talked about the fact that elements within the same group, what's a group? The columns of the periodic table are groups. And elements within the same group have similar properties, like the noble gases. Well, if you look at the group that carbon's a member of, those other members have the same valence. Notice that they're the same number of steps away from the right edge. So carbon is not the only tetravalent element, the point I'm making, but among the tetravalent elements that you see on the periodic table, what is special about carbon? Yeah, that's a good answer. That's not the one I intended. But now if I were to ask a kindergartner, they probably wouldn't give me that answer. But I say kindergartner because people tend to overthink this question. What I was looking for is that among those in that group, carbon is the smallest. It's at the top of the list. So it is the smallest atom that has tetravalence. And smaller atoms are more prevalent in the universe. There's a hell of a lot of hydrogen in the universe, for instance, the simplest atom. So being the smallest tetravalent atom, it is especially versatile and available for its versatility. And that's why there is a huge half of chemistry devoted to the chemistry of carbon-containing compounds, including life. Now, four is really here just as a kind of a history note. This is the structural formula of urea, which is a waste product when amino acids from proteins get broken down for energy, which is proteins are usually used for other reasons than energy. But anyway, it's part of urine, and that's not the point of the slide. The point of the slide is that this is an organic compound. Well, there's millions of organic compounds, so that's nothing special. But what's special about urea historically is that it is the first successfully synthesized organic compound, meaning first time we made an organic substance out of inorganic substances, which we thought up until then was impossible, and that's why we were saying the stuff of living organisms is somehow chemically special. You can't make it unless you use materials from other organisms. Well, that's not true, actually. It just is historically important for that reason. All right, let's talk more about organic molecules and more specifically, the ones that we see in slide 5. These are all hopefully obvious to you that they're organic. But more specifically, how would you describe these? In addition to being organic, more specifically than saying they're organic compounds, what are all of these? What do they all have in common? Right, every one of them is a hydrocarbon. Every one of them contains nothing but carbon and hydrogen. That's it. And so even though hydrocarbons are just part of overall organic compounds, just the set of hydrocarbons is limitless, really. There's no limit to how many hydrocarbons you could produce. A huge number of possibilities. And so there are different ways to categorize them, which is useful because there's so many of them to keep track of them. We like to classify things. One way, and those are shown by the letters here, A, B, C, and D. One way shown in A is to simply categorize them by, categorize hydrocarbons, that is, by the length of their carbon skeleton. The carbon skeleton is what we call the whole number of carbons that are in that molecule, which is in teal shading here. It's not the entire molecule, but just the carbons themselves form what we call the carbon skeleton, and then the hydrogens are connected to that skeleton. So notice that ethane here and propane both end in A-N-E. That's not by coincidence. That's by plan. These are hydrocarbons that have only single bonds. And hydrocarbons that have only single bonds are called alkanes. So alkane is not a specific chemical. It's a category. Alkanes means hydrocarbons with only single bonds. And therefore, any specific kind of alkane has a name that ends in A and E to remind us of that. Ethane, propane, octane. There's all kinds of alkanes, but only single bonds. Anyway, what's being illustrated here in A is that ethane differs from propane in the length of its carbon skeleton. Another way, though, is by branching, shown in B. Classify based on branching or lack of branching. Well, there is no branching when you have only one carbon or two or three. But as soon as you have four or more, you can have branching. Right? Butane is a four-carbon compound, but so is 2-methylpropane. Butane and 2-methylpropane have exactly the same chemical formula because they have exactly the same number of each of the carbon of carbon and hydrogen. Right? Which is why a chemical formula, which, you know, like H2O for water, every molecule has a chemical formula, but a chemical formula does not necessarily tell you what you have. Because the same chemical formula can apply to more than one different substance. And we call those things, if they have the same chemical formula, isomers. By the way, you should not confuse isomer with isotope. And I don't remember whether I spent much time on isotope, if at all. An isotope, isotopes are different versions of the same element. Okay, so remember, for instance, that hydrogen is hydrogen only because it has exactly one proton. All hydrogen atoms have one proton exactly. But some of them have no neutrons. Some of them have one neutron. And therefore, there's two different versions of hydrogen based on how many neutrons there are. Those are called isotopes. Here we're talking about different molecules, not atoms, different molecules that have the same number and types of elements, and therefore they have the same chemical formula. Those are called isomers. But notice butane, which is C4H10, And 2-methylpropane, which is C4H10, differ in the fact that butane does not have a branched carbon skeleton, whereas 2-methylpropane does. And these prefixes, by the way, meth means one, methane has one carbon, eth means two, prop means three, but means four, pent means five, hex, there's hexane, and so on. That's how those get their names. All right, then C, another way to classify hydrocarbons, is based on whether or not they have double bonds. As I said, if there aren't any multiple bonds, only single bonds, then they're alkanes. But here we have two alkenes. Alkenes are hydrocarbons that have at least one double bond. They can have more than one double bond, but they have to have at least one to be an alkene. And alkene endings end in ene. Butene is just like butane, except instead of having these extra two hydrogens, which would take up the bonds here, the carbons are double bonded. These two carbons are double bonded. And 1-butene, named for the position, the one being the position of the double bond, is chemically different from 2-butene, even though it's very close to the same molecule. They're isomers as well, but they have different properties based on that different position of the double bond. And then finally, we can classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not they have rings. A ringed structure is simply the carbon skeleton at one place folding back and connecting to itself, forming a ring. And there's plenty of examples of that. Cyclohexane and benzene are two examples. So notice that a ring can have nothing but single bonds, or it can actually include double bonds as well. All right, let's go to 6. Now, we have not yet gotten to the chapter where we take a close look at all four of the biological macromolecules that we've already talked about. We'll get into that detail later, but here we have a fat. This cartoon on the right is one fat molecule. And the reason it's in this chapter is because a fat is largely hydrocarbon. It's not, of course, because there are oxygens in there as well. But if you build a fat, you really start with four things: a glycerol and three fatty acids. And then the fatty acids, one by one, are connected to the glycerol. That makes a fat. We'll talk about this detail later. But a fatty acid, except the end that does have one oxygen atom in it, all the rest of it is nothing but carbons and hydrogens. And the reason that's significant biologically is that hydrocarbons in general, whatever they are, make excellent fuels. There is a lot of energy stored in carbon-hydrogen bonds. And hydrocarbons, being made up of nothing but carbon and hydrogen, have a lot of those bonds. So this is why, for instance, we use hydrocarbons for so many industrial fuels, right? Gasoline is just a mixture of hydrocarbons. You know, the pump will give you an octane rating. Well, octane is just one of many alkanes that are mixed together in the mixture we call gasoline. They're all hydrocarbons, though, and therefore burning them releases a lot of energy. That's true not only for internal combustion engines, but also for organisms. And this is why fats, which have so many carbon-hydrogen bonds in them, they're not technically hydrocarbons, but they're close. That's why they're able to store so much energy. And when we take in more energy as food than we actually need at the moment, we've evolved to save that, because over evolutionary time, food has been scarce. So if you take in more than you need, whatever you take it in as, the body will transform it into fat to store it for later. because it's an efficient way of storing that energy. If we had to store our energy as carbohydrate or as protein, we would have to weigh a lot more, because a fat contains a lot more energy in the same amount of grams, has a high energy density. Seven. Well, I've already introduced the word isomer. Now we're going to talk about three categories of isomers. And there are more than three categories, actually. If you were taking an organic chemistry course, you would learn more. But in this course, we'll talk about these three categories. Notice that they are structural isomers, geometric isomers, and enantiomers. Let's talk about structural isomers at the top. I already actually did talk about this a little bit. Structural isomers are simply different versions by different versions of the same chemical formula by virtue of a simple rearrangement of the carbon skeleton. Pentane and 2-methylbutane have the same chemical formula, but their skeletons are arranged differently. And that makes them different substances with different properties. Okay, now geometric isomers is different. If you can imagine this, you haven't done the ball and stick modeling yet, but you will later today. But when you play with ball and stick models, and you can kind of imagine it with this cartoon down here, if you have a single bond between atoms, which is like one stick between two balls, you'll be able to twist those balls, right, on that stick. But if you have a double bond, you can't swivel it. So it keeps those two atoms in place with respect to each other. There's no swiveling. And that's what brings up geometric isomers. Notice, for there to be geometric isomers, there has to be a double bond. And therefore, what's connected to these carbons can't swivel, because the carbon itself can't swivel. So X, which represents anything other than hydrogen, there's no element X, just means something else. In this version, they're locked on this side of the overall molecule, because it can't swivel. And on this one, they're locked on opposite sides. So that makes two different versions of the isomers. They are called cis and trans. Cis means same side, trans means across. So we use those terms in other senses as well, like cisgender and transgender, for instance. But that's the difference. All right, those are distinct chemicals as well. The third one, and the last one for this course, is enantiomers. And enantiomers are examples of stereoisomers. Stereo means solid, meaning three-dimensional. Of course, they're all three-dimensional, but that's why it's called that. And enantiomers are examples of isomers that have chirality. So enantiomers are said to be chiral compounds. And that word chiral means handed, having handedness, which is why the hands are shown here. All right? Now, just think about your hands before we look at the molecules. Left and right hands of the same person are very similar, but they are not the same, right? If you just think of it in space, and if you were able to safely cut off your hands and still work with them, or cut someone else's hands off and work with them, there's no way that you can just rearrange a right hand and make it into a left. They are distinct because they're mirror images of each other. They're not the same as each other. So hands, of course, have chirality, handedness. It's the same root as in chiropractor, for instance, which is a person who works on you with the hands. Molecules can be handed or chiral as well, and we call those enantiomers. This happens easily with carbon because of its tetravalence. So we have ball and stick models for two different isomers. They're isomers because they have exactly the same chemical formula. But if carbon is in the middle, and the four corners are the things that are it's bonded to, if all four corners are different things, then it's a handed or chiral molecule. Because just like the hand, there's no way you could have this ball and stick model be built and without doing anything to it, just picking it up and turning it around or anything, you can't make it into this. The only way to do that is to break two of the bonds and switch them. So they're distinct molecules. Now these ones are even more similar to each other than the other isomers are. But they still are, they act differently. And for instance, slide 8 shows you an example of this. Here we have some drugs shown here, which are exogenous signals, like I've talked about before. But we don't produce our own versions of these, but they act as signals in the body because, like all signals, they have their receptors for them. Otherwise, they wouldn't do anything, right? Well, a receptor is kind of like a glove compared to a hand. There has to be a good fit between the signal molecule and the receptor. You can think of it as lock and key as well, but hand and glove, same thing. You know, you don't have a good, unless it's surgical gloves, you don't have really a good fit if you try to put your right hand into a left glove, even if your own gloves. There has to be a good fit between the signal molecule and the receptor. And if there isn't, then nothing will happen. It's the same as not having a receptor at all. The ligand is not going to bind. The signal is the ligand. Well, there are plenty of signals that are chiral compounds, meaning there's two versions of the signal, a left-handed version and a right-handed version. But an organism will have only right-handed or only left-handed receptors. So only one of the two possible signals can work in the body. But it just depends on the signal as to whether it's supposed to be left-handed or right-handed. In the case of ibuprofen, you have S-ibuprofen, R-ibuprofen. Those are the two names for the isomers. But the only one that works in the body, the effective enantiomer, is the S version. Because the receptor is left-handed. Now the S here stands for sinistral. Which means left-handed. So does the word sinister, by the way, which is just one way in which we are kind of mean to the left-handers of the world. I mean, that's what sinister literally means. Be suspicious of that person because he's left-handed. And that's obviously not a good reason to be leery of someone, but that's how it got started. And the R stands for recto, which means right, like in a rectangle, the right angles. Ibuprofen, the left-handed version, works because our body has left-handed receptors. On the other hand, for albuterol, the right-handed version works, the left-handed version does not. They're almost identical molecules, but the handedness matters. 9 is just another example, except here we have a signal that could be endogenous or exogenous. You can use it as a drug, but we also make it ourselves. Well, at least L-DOPA, which is the effective enantiomer. That's what our body makes, and if we take it as a drug, it has to be L-DOPA. Otherwise, it won't work because D-DOPA is the wrong-handedness. This uses a different system of naming them versus S and R. L stands for levo, which means left, and D stands for dextro, which means right. This is another way that we don't like left-handers. Dextrous literally means right-handed. Ambidextrous literally means having two right hands. Well, it's, of course, it doesn't. That's not the truth. We just mean that person can use both hands. Therefore, he has two right hands, two useful hands. Anyway, that's what it means. And you see the L on a lot of drug names. That's what it's referring to. Levo. There's two different versions: left-handed and right-handed. Well, that just depends. It's on a case-by-case basis, on a signal-by-signal basis, because it's not. There's no rule to it. It's just whatever we've evolved to have that kind of receptor for.
Yeah, but I was meaning to use more the S and R.
Oh, the two systems. They actually are different from each other. They're defined differently. They both mean left-handed and right-handed, like I said, but for. Depending on what kind of chemical it is, you use one system or another, but based on whether it has to do with light or it's. There's reasoning behind it, but it's not important for this course. All right, that brings us to 10. And here we have two. These are not isomers anymore. We have two different organic compounds here. Estradiol is the main estrogen in your body, and testosterone is another hormone. These are both hormones, right? There are different categories of hormones. These happen to be steroid hormones. Not all hormones are steroid hormones, but the sex hormones, along with some others, are. And these ones happen to be pretty opposite in effect, right? Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. Despite the fact that they're almost identical when you look at them, right? Very similar. Well, the reason they're very similar, by the way, makes sense because both of these and also all other steroid hormones in animals start out as the same thing, which is similar itself, and it just gets slightly modified into any of the various steroid hormones. Do you know what that precursor molecule is?
Cholesterol.
Yes, which no animals can live without. That's just one of the reasons. Cholesterol is a lipid, and it has this same ring structure that's shown in yellow here. That's really what still looks like cholesterol. But when cholesterol gets modified to make other things like the steroid hormones, really what's happening is that there's just a slight modification of the stuff that hangs off of these rings. And that can make a huge difference, obviously. Estrogen works totally differently compared to testosterone because of these small changes. Coal, by the way, of cholesterol means bile. And cholesterol is a component of bile, the stuff that the liver makes. And like I said before, stereo means solid. OL means it's an alcohol. So cholesterol literally means bile, solid alcohol. But it's the precursor. Animals in general cannot live without it. Plants don't make cholesterol, but they make similar structures called phytosterols, which makes sense because phyto means plant. Anyway, the reason that I'm showing you these hormones in this chapter is to illustrate a use of what are shown with the blue shading. These blue shaded parts of these molecules are examples of functional groups. A functional group is not an entire molecule. A functional group is a relatively small collection of atoms arranged in a certain way that are part of an overall bigger molecule. But they're called functional groups because if a molecule has a particular functional group, that molecule will have a particular function because of that, or it will work in a certain chemical way because of that functional group. All right? And there are more functional groups that you would learn in a chemistry course than you would here, but we're going to learn the ones that are particularly important to biology in this course. And that's going to be in a table. Well, the book I took this from is from a one table that's two slides long, 11 and 12. Notice the similarity. So let me go through these. All of these columns, each column is a different functional group, gives the name, of course, in red at the top, but then it gives a little ball and stick model. And notice that what I said moment ago is true. You can tell by looking at these ball and stick models that these are not complete molecules, right? Otherwise, they would have something at the other end of the stick that's hanging off. So a functional group is just a part of a molecule that's bigger. And aside from the ball and stick model, they also have a chemical formula that you can represent them by. A structural formula, I should say, not a chemical formula. Once again, though, with a stick hanging off. Sometimes at the other end of the stick that's not hooked to anything at the moment, you see R used instead. Like this first one is hydroxyl. It could be ROH rather than just dash OH. If you see that, the R stands for residue, which simply means the rest. It's the rest of the molecule that it's part of. In other words, you would never see a functional group just by itself. It's not a complete molecule. All right, well, let's talk about hydroxyl, which, as you see, is an OH. The hydroxyl group is OH, but the O has the dash on it. Now, it doesn't matter. This can be written differently. So dash OH is one way you can write it, as shown here. But you could write it also as HO dash. You cannot, though, write it as dash HO or OH dash. What's wrong with those? But why is that a problem?
Well, because the hydrogen doesn't have any electrons to share.
Why? Because it's connected to the oxygen. It's already forming the only one bond it can make with oxygen. Oxygen has to make two. It's only making one with the hydrogen, and that's why it has to make the other bond with the rest of the molecule. So these are wrong, but either of these is right. And you could put R's on either one of them if you wanted to. Okay, that's a hydroxyl, and all kinds of different compounds have at least one hydroxyl in them. If a compound includes a hydroxyl, then it's a member of a category of compounds that we collectively call alcohols. That's what makes something an alcohol. And we tend to think about one kind of alcohol particularly, ethanol, which is exactly the same chemical whether it's in beer, wine, or spirits. But ethanol is just one of many, many possible alcohols. Anything with a hydroxyl group is an alcohol. And alcohol, the word, which is a category, not a specific substance, ends in O-L, like alkane ended in A-N-E, and all the particular alkanes' names end in A-N-E. Well, specific alcohols have names that end in O-L to remind us of that, like cholesterol. If you go back to that cholesterol picture, it has, well, I didn't show you cholesterol, but cholesterol has an OH in it. That's why it's an alcohol. And this is ethanol, the booze alcohol. Okay? By the way, notice the name, ethanol. It gets that name because it's just like ethane, which would be the same exact thing as you see here, except just an H here. It would be an alkane.
So ethanol is ethane-like alcohol.
That's why it's named that. And biologically, alcohols are important because the OH, just like the O and the H in water, makes an alcohol have polarity at that functional group and therefore interacts with things that are polar. Next up is the carbonyl group. And this one, notice, involves a double bond. It's a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. Well, that double bond satisfies two of carbon's four bonds that it has to make. And the other two are unspecified. So that you could write that with two R's here. And that means that there's, as far as categories are concerned, of compounds containing carbonyl, there's two major categories, because there's two possible ways in which this carbonyl can be placed. And those are shown in the two pictures. One of these two ways is for the carbon that is part of the carbonyl to be on a tip of the skeleton. Now, a skeleton can have two tips or many tips, depending on if there's branching. But by a tip, I mean it's the end of the line as far as the carbon is concerned. There's nothing, no more carbon after it. That's one possibility. And that's shown in this bottom of the two pictures, which is propanol. Acetone here shows the other possibility, though. The other possibility is that the carbon of the carbonyl is not at a tip of the skeleton. It doesn't have to be exactly in the middle like it is here, just anywhere other than the tip. Or anywhere other than a tip. Okay? Those are two basic possibilities, and therefore we have two different names of compounds based on these possibilities. Compounds that have a carbonyl that is at the tip, or at a tip, are called aldehydes collectively. That's this word, but I'll write it bigger. Whoops. All right. That's if they if the carbonyl is at a tip. And compounds that have a carbonyl but it's not at a tip are called ketones. And a long time ago when I would get confused about which one was which, I realized something about the lettering here. The word aldehyde starts with an A, which is at one tip of the alphabet. So that can help you remember that if it works for you. K, as in ketone, it's in the middle of the alphabet, right? So use that if it helps you, but those are the two categories. They both contain carbonyl, though. And for various reasons, these are important, including that the simple carbohydrates that we'll talk about later, which are called monosaccharides, are rich in carbonyl groups. And they are very important biological molecules for reasons of energy. Okay, next up is the carboxyl group. Now look at the functional group's structural formula here and be careful with it, because it would be easy to say, well, this is just a carbonyl and a hydroxyl. And actually, that's true, it is. But when you have a carbonyl connected to a hydroxyl in exactly that way, we don't consider it to be a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. Instead, the whole thing is one functional group called the carboxyl. But notice that it's named exactly for the fact that it's a combination of a carbonyl and a hydroxyl. Carboxyl. Well, the carbon is making three bonds just within the functional group, so that the rest of the molecule, is connected to that carbon as well. The kinds of compounds that contain a carboxyl are collectively called either carboxylic acids, or sometimes organic acids. They're acids, of course, that's why that's in the name. A lot of acids, though, are not organic, like hydrochloric acid. It's just hydrogen and chlorine. Sulfuric acid, just hydrogen, sulfur, and oxygen. No carbon. Organic acids have carbon in them because you have to have a carbon to have a carboxyl, of course. Well, it's very hard to overstress the importance of these biologically because carboxylic acids include what are called amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. And proteins are, they do everything important in cells of all types. Okay, so every individual amino acid that's part of a protein has a carboxyl group in it, or it's not an amino acid. Continuing in the same table, but in slide 12 now, we have next up the amino group, which is a word, a form of the word that should always tell you it's involving nitrogen. When you see amino, amine, ammo, any of those forms, it's referring to nitrogen, is somehow involved. But the amino functional group is a nitrogen singly bonded to each of two hydrogens. Nitrogen has a valence of 3, of course, so the R is the rest of the molecule with nitrogen. And we call substances that contain an amino group amines. Well, there are all kinds of different amines, but a biologically very important subgroup of amines are the things that we call amino acids, which I just got done describing for carboxylic acids. Amino acids not only include a carboxyl group, like this one right here is a carboxyl, every amino acid also has an amino group, and that's why they're called amino acids. The amino comes from the amino group, the acid comes from the carboxylic acid part, the carboxyl group. So you can't make any proteins without amino groups either. Very important. Next up is the sulfhydryl group, SH. Notice that sulfur has the same valence, since it's in the same group, as oxygen. A valence of 2. And that's why sulfur has to be making that second bond. Now, also notice that SH is most similar to which one that we already learned. Sulfhydryl is most similar to which one? The hydroxyl. Because sulfur is very much like oxygen, right? Instead of OH, it's SH. Because elements in the same group have similar properties, a sulfhydryl group is similar in chemical properties to a hydroxyl, but obviously it's using a sulfur instead. Well, we call the category of chemicals that have a sulfhydryl thiols. Notice that word. Now, the thi part of that means sulfur. So when you see thio whatever as part of a chemical name, it means there's sulfur in it. But it's thiol. And I just told you before that things that end in ol are alcohols, right, that have hydroxyl. Well, a thiol is not a true alcohol. But the word linguistically means sulfur alcohol, meaning it's like an alcohol except it has sulfur instead of oxygen. Still has similar properties though because of polarity. Sulfur has a higher electronegativity than hydrogen does. And in biology, once again using proteins, it's important because cysteine here is one of the 20 biological amino acids that organisms make their proteins out of. And notice that there's a sulfhydryl in it. Well, when proteins take their shape, what starts out as a string of amino acids folds up into a certain three-dimensional shape. And that can bring two sulfhydryl-containing amino acids close together so that the sulfhydryl of one and the sulfhydryl of the other will react chemically. They'll both lose a hydrogen, and the two S's will be covalently bonded together. And that really locks the shape of that protein in place. making it very strong. There's a lot of this in the protein making up hair, making it very strong stuff. But it's also why it smells like sulfur if you burn it. Next up is phosphate. And this one is the most complex functional group that we're going to learn in terms of number of atoms. Notice that it's a phosphorus atom. That's P stands for phosphorus, not phosphate. The phosphate is the phosphorus atom, but there are also four oxygen atoms, notice. One of those four oxygen is also making the connection with the rest of the molecule. And there's many reasons why we can't have any organisms without phosphate. One reason is that the building blocks that nucleic acids are made out of, which includes DNA and RNA, those building blocks are called nucleotides. We'll get into that later. But every nucleotide, in order to be a nucleotide, has to have a phosphate. So DNA has millions of phosphates in it. You can't have DNA without it. That alone is important. Phosphate is also an important component of the most important energy-carrying molecule in organisms, which is ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It has phosphates on it, and that's what allows it to store energy temporarily. Plus, phosphates can be moved around, stuck on or taken off of proteins. And this can act like a little switch to phosphorylate a protein, which means to stick a phosphate group onto it. And to dephosphorylate it means to take it off of it. And therefore, it can act like, what I mean by acting like a little switch is, instead of destroying a protein when you no longer want it to work, you can keep it built, but turn it off by either phosphorylating or dephosphorylating it, and then it's still there at the ready if you need to switch it back on. All right, now let's go to methyl. The methyl group is ubiquitous. You find these all over the place in organic chemistry. That's because it's a carbon with three hydrogens, and then the carbon is part of the carbon skeleton, of course. The reason you find them everywhere is because every little tip of a carbon skeleton, the easiest way to complete the valence is just to add three hydrogens to that carbon on the tip, which is a methyl group. So there, you find them in a lot of organic molecules. But these can also be used as switches. You can methylate or demethylate molecules, just like you can phosphorylate them and dephosphorylate them. And this is one way that we can turn genes on and off. The gene is always there, but it's not appropriate to use the gene. For instance, all of your cells, except for your blood cells, your red blood cells don't have any DNA, but the rest of your cells all have the same genes. But you wouldn't want all of those genes to be turned on in any given cell. You don't want the gene for responsible for growing the proteins that make the lens of the eye to be activated in a stomach cell. It could be, but that's not appropriate, right? So genes need to be turned off sometimes for a lifetime in certain cells. And you can do that with methylation. Well, that leaves only 13 for this chapter, and therefore for the unit. And I've already mentioned ATP. Here we see ATP, which stands for adenosine triphosphate. And those phosphate-phosphate bonds hold a lot of energy. And we'll be talking a lot more about this molecule when we're in Unit 3, which is all about energy. But we use this, we make this molecule by adding phosphate to turn it into ATP, and the energy required to do that comes from the food that we eat. So now some of that energy that was in the food is in this molecule, but this is a very versatile molecule that can be used for a lot of different things that require energy. To spend it or use it, all you have to do is take off one of these phosphates, and that turns it into adenosine diphosphate plus a phosphate by itself, which we call inorganic phosphate, because it's not connected to a carbon skeleton anymore. It's just a phosphorus and four oxygen atoms. So there's plenty of time to talk still about ATP. It's just showing you a picture here now. But let me just say something more about the fact that P stands for phosphorus, not phosphate. P by itself stands for phosphorus. But P with a circle around it is just a standard shorthand for the phosphate group. So only the P is shown here, but you have to imagine the four oxygens there as well in reality. Right? And the subscript I here simply means inorganic. So this is a phosphate group, but it's just an ion by itself. It's not part of a molecule at the moment. That should conclude the unit. Yes, it does. So, before I stop the recorder, do you have any questions about this unit? Everyone buy a Scantron forms? Don't forget them on Tuesday. But you go ahead. Yeah, I wrote it. 50. There's 50 exactly on all five exams. They're all multiple choice. And as far as choices are concerned, there's four choices, A, B, C, D, for each. So that's the answers, A, B, C, and D. You just have to figure out the correct order on the Scantron form. Any other questions? Yeah?
You said they sell the Scantron form at the bookstore, right?
That's what I'm told. I've never actually been in the bookstore. Yeah, that's where they sell them. How much do they ream you for them?
$3 for six.
Three? Well, I mean, it's not like $3 is a lot, but it's six pieces of paper.
Yeah.
It's really kind of outrageous, but we used to give them to you, but we can't anymore for some reason. Anything else? Okay, then I'll see you downstairs.